Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson, sitting in for Ann this week and next week as well. Ads for prescription drugs are everywhere, and often the litany of possible side effects is worrisome and wide-ranging: restlessness, anxiety, stroke, headache, and in some cases, even death. For consumers who want to know the effectiveness and dangers of a medication, it takes more than just reading the fine print. A recent conference of the Institute of Medicine and the FDA, the Federal Food and Drug Administration, met to discuss how best to convey a drug's risks and benefits. The first step? Avoid the medical jargon. Joining us now is a panelist at that convention and an advocate of easy-to-understand drug information, and also a professor of family and community medicine at Dartmouth College, Dr. Stephen Woloshin. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. Yeah, as someone who goes to the pharmacy about once a month to pick up a medication that I take. I would be all in favor of a little clarity and a little bit better information. So clearly you're hearing that from the public too.
Sure. I mean, a lot of people are disappointed by the quality of the information that they can get about how well drugs work.
Yeah, I guess as a case in point, my mother, who just turned 92 years old, it takes several different medications, not for anything major, just generally things that affect older people, but I find she's often saying, well, gee, I'm not sure if I should take this with that or whatever, and of course every time I hear her say that, I said, Ma, you need to talk to your doctor, or at the very least talk to the pharmacist and make sure that this is okay. But I hear what you're saying is that maybe there's a better way. And one of the things that you've proposed is the idea of a drug fact box. So tell us about that fact box and what it is and how it would work.
Sure. So the purpose of the box is to make sure that doctors and patients, people like your mother, and you can get clear, unbiased information about how well drugs work, so about the benefits, the harms, and the uncertainty, so they can make a wise decision about whether or not they want to be taking the drug, and then about how to use it most safely. And as you said, one of the problems is it's hard to get good information, and it matters because drugs can have an important effect on our health. It can be a matter of life or death. Like your mother, lots of Americans take them. I think over the age of 65, the average American's taken 3. And bad information matters. People might forego drugs that can help because they don't appreciate how much they help, especially drugs that lower risk factors where you don't feel the benefit. But also they may take drugs that don't really help or are even harmful, or if they understood the benefits and the harms, they wouldn't want to take them. So it's really important to get people the good information. But the problem is it's hard to do it. And so we developed the drug facts box, and that's just a simple way to summarize the best available information about how well drugs work. And again, about benefits, harms, and uncertainties. And what we do is we largely use information that we derive from the FDA when they review drugs to approve them. So this is the idea is to help make sure that everyone understands and knows what FDA knew at the time of approval. For older drugs, we supplement this by looking at the literature, subsequent studies that have come out. But largely, we're using this FDA information. And then the problem is it comes in these hundreds and hundreds of pages of poorly organized and very difficult to read sources, and we organize it and we distill it down to very simple basics that people need.
Give me an example. Let's say of a particular drug and how this would work with that.
Sure. So I think a good example is there's a sleeping pill that's very popular. I think it's the most well recognized ad campaign. It's Lunesta. Everyone knows the green Lunesta moth. Mm-hmm. And the ad tells you, it implies that you're going to get 8 hours of restful sleep if you take the drug. But what we show in those drug boxes, if you look at the actual data, it turns out that people, compared to people who take a placebo, so an inactive sugar pill, people who take Lunesta, on average get to sleep about 15 minutes faster than placebo, and they sleep about 37 minutes longer, which is very different than what's implied in the ad. And in fact, on average, the people in the studies still met the the definition of insomnia. They were only sleeping on average about a little under six and a half hours. The other thing that the drug box shows is that there are also important harms. So, for example, people who took Lunesta, 26%, about a quarter, had a very bad taste in their mouth, persistent bad taste, compared to about 5% who took placebo. About 10% of people felt next day drowsiness compared to 3% on placebo. So there's these downsides as well. And you can't get that if you look at the ad. You just see this Luna Moth and these happy, sleepy people. But if you look at the actual data in the drug facts box, you can judge, oh, this is the size of the benefit I can expect. These are the kind of harms I can expect. Now you can make an informed decision. Is it really worth it to me?
Kind of a reality check. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson. And if you've got a question or a comment that you'd like to make to Dr. Woloshin, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Woloshin, where would this fact box be? I mean, I'm trying to visualize, is it on the bottle? Is it on the paper sack that you get from, from the pharmacist? Where would it physically be so
right.
people are familiar?
So the initial inspiration was actually the nutrition facts box, that little box that you see on all food products. But the idea is not to put this on a drug bottle or something like that. It's you couldn't read it. And also, by the time you have the drug bottle, you've already purchased the medicine. And this information is probably most valuable even before the decision to take the medicine is made. So our idea is that these things would be available to people in lots of different ways. One of the best ways, we're really happy to say, is that Consumer Reports magazine has now made a number of these drug boxes available for free to the public for drugs treating Alzheimer's, for some weight loss drugs, and actually going to release a few more shortly. But our dream is to disseminate these things broadly to consumers, but also to doctors, to prescribers, because they need this information when they are seeing patients so that they understand the benefits and harms, and also to help them communicate them to the patients. So we'd like to get them into the medical record as well.
How do we do this in an era? I mean, as electronically oriented as everyone seems to be, we still have a large portion of the population that either doesn't have access to a computer or doesn't know. I mean, again, I hate to keep bringing up my mom, but my mom's pretty typical. I mean, she's still dealing with how to use a cell phone. So how do we get beyond, you can look it up on the webpage.
Right. Well, that's one of the great things about Consumer Reports. They actually published print, you can get it. But your point is well taken, how to get this into the hands of consumers. So we have a bunch of ideas. I mean, one way would be through, health centers or doctor's offices. So when people are seeing their providers, it's possible that they could, if they don't have a computer of their own, they can have it printed out at the doctor's office. If they're available through resources like Consumer Reports, you can do it at the library. You're making a good point, and that's one of the challenges. We're our company's called Informulary. We're trying to deal with this exact challenge, and that's something as a new startup that we're grappling with.
Tell me a little bit about the rolling this out, because again, there, not a lot of people are aware that this even existed, and frankly, before the show, neither was I. So, I was aware of all of the issues and the problems,
sure.
But not that that there was something being developed to deal with this. So how is this being rolled out nationally?
Sure. Well, the idea is not new. It's old. We've been at this for over 10 years, and initially. And I say we, I'm Lisa Schwartz, who's my wife and also the person who developed all this work together. We initially wanted FDA to do it, and so we worked for a long time trying to convince FDA to provide this sort of summary whenever a new drug comes out. And eventually, we were invited to present at an FDA public meeting about risk communication, and their Risk Communication Advisory Council voted unanimously that FDA should adopt the drug facts box approach for their communications to the public. And it was actually written into the Affordable Care Act. And unfortunately, FDA decided that last year they wrote a letter to Congress that was required to talk about their progress. And they said they needed 3 to 5 more years to you know, to study the issue before they could move forward. And at that point, the person who was funding us, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, encouraged us to try to do this on our own rather than wait for FDA. And they gave us some funding to work with people, experienced business people, to try to figure out what's the best, you know, way to create a self-sustaining model to generate this information and disseminate it. And that's how we decided to create this company. And you know, we're still in the early phases of it. We're developing this database of data of information on all drugs, and so this is sort of like a soft rollout. And so we're at the same time that we're developing the database, we're starting to reach out to potential, you know, customers.
Again, just to remind everybody, you are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we've got a caller, Jerry, from Columbus. And Jerry, I need to ask you to keep this very brief because we're kind of running up to the end of the segments here.
Good morning. I wanted to say that my own doctor, when I had my physical in February, annual physical, agreed with me. I said, why are they allowing these prescription drugs to give these commercials that say it could result, even some of them, in death? I said, that's ridiculous. And he totally agreed with me. My late wife used to get the publication Best Drugs, Worst Drugs.
Yes.
And one more thing, these drug companies, you know, most companies make a 5% net profit. If I'm up to speed on this, the prescription drug companies make a net profit of about 15%, but the media isn't going to tell anything about it because, Mr. Nicholson, people don't realize it, but this country is heading into a plutocracy or an oligarchy.
Okay.
And you know what that is.
Jerry, let me cut you short here and get a response from Dr. Voloshin. Dr. Voloshin.
Well, sure. So, I mean, the issue about whether we should allow direct-to-consumer advertising, you know, that's a great question. We're the only country besides New Zealand that allows it. The European Union, not long ago, convened a panel and decided against doing it. So it's sort of an anomaly. And there are lots of arguments for and against it. And you know, your caller raised some of the issues against it. But I would say that I don't think these ads are going to be going away anytime soon. So the question is, how can we make them better? How can we make the playing field more even for consumers who sometimes get information about drugs this way? And rather than having this litany of side effects like your caller mentioned, something like a drug facts box is the way to do it, because you don't want to just know about the harms. You want to also know about the benefits, to weigh them together to decide, is the benefit worth the harm? And the way that they do it in these advertising is not helpful. People can't get the gist of the information. That's what these drug facts boxes are meant to do, to help people understand at a glance what's the likely benefit. You know, how often does it happen? What are the likely harms? How often do they happen? What are the major uncertainties? And put them together, and then they can make a wiser decision, hopefully with their prescriber.
Dr. Voloshin, we've got about a minute left. Let me ask you, are you getting any pushback from the drug industry on this effort?
You know, everyone always asks that question, and you know, they always think that, you know, farmers are going to be coming after us. But we haven't really gotten much pushback at all. I think one reason is that we're small and we're just starting, and we'll see. You know, ask me in a year how it's going. But right now we haven't. And I think whether we do or we don't, we're gonna move full steam ahead because we think it's so important, not just for consumers who we've been focusing on, but also for prescribers. Doctors are trained when they know about if a patient has condition X, you use drug Y, but they're not necessarily trained to ask the question, how big is the benefit? How big are the harms? And that information is hard to come by. And so we think this is a really important resource, not only for patients and consumers, but also for doctors.
Yeah, absolutely. For clarity's sake alone, I think most people would probably agree with you. This is Dr. Stephen Voloshin, who is a professor of family and community medicine at Dartmouth College and an advocate of easy to understand drug information and talking about this new fact box. Dr. Voloshin, thank you very much for joining us this morning on All Sides. All Sides with Ann Fisher. It will continue in a few moments on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday. I'm Stu Nicholson sitting in for Ann here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. And again, let me say, we're open for calls, so 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's still plenty of summer left, but back to school time is just around the corner, and it's coming up fast. There's already schools that are getting ready to go back into session in the coming month. For most kids, this means new pencils and new sneakers, but it often means new immunizations, too. School checkups are a standard late summer ritual, but they've changed quite a bit in recent years. Doctors are now trying to screen for more than just high blood pressure and chicken pox. With us to discuss back-to-school checkups 101, what you need to know before that first day, is a pediatrician at Nationwide Children's Hospital and the host of the Pediacast podcast, Dr. Mike Patrick. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
Great. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. It's good to have you here. I've got several friends with kids that are just about to start school for the first time, both pre-K and K and going into first grade. So this is a very, to say the least, timely issue. I can still remember having to go through this myself as both a parent and a very young patient.
Right.
So let's start with the basics. Should every kid have a back to school checkup, and why?
Well, the most important thing is that kids are checked every year by their doctor. So it doesn't necessarily have to be right before school starts, but I think just having that contact once a year is an important thing. So if it's not something that's been done in the past year, then I would definitely try to get it scheduled before school starts. But it doesn't necessarily have to be in the month or two, before the start of the school year.
So, what are the elements? What should a parent's expectations be out of a good back to school checkup?
Well, really, they should any questions that they have or any concerns that they have really should be addressed. So, I think that's probably the most important thing. I mean, as doctors, we want to be advocates for families. We want to be able to answer questions and really be partners with parents and helping them to raise their kids and to supervise the health maintenance of their kids. So, sometimes parents are embarrassed to come with that list of questions, but we'd rather keep the conversation on track and make it as beneficial for the family as possible. And then, of course, you want enough time. So this isn't something that we don't want to practice fast food medicine. It's not in and out. You want a good 15 minutes or longer to be able to try to address those concerns, and then for the doctor to be able to ask questions about the history and to do a good complete physical examination and just make sure the kid's growing okay and is healthy, that immunizations are up to date, and that there aren't any other outstanding concerns.
So it actually is a good idea for a parent to maybe sit down at the dining room table the night before and just work out a short list of questions and things like that to bring up, so that you know what to ask and bring forward to your pediatrician.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, if you can't think of any, we'll have plenty that we'll be able to bring up and talk to you about. But I do think that whatever the parent's question priority is, you definitely want to address those first so that you make sure that you're not, short-sighting what's really of concern for that particular family.
I'm curious because there's been a lot of debate over the last several years in the media and elsewhere over the necessity of shots and stuff like that. How do you deal with that question from a parent saying, does my kid really need this shot or that vaccination or whatever?
I'm personally all about evidence-based medicine, and I don't buy into conspiracy theories. I really want to know what does the evidence tell me, and I want to know where that evidence is coming from, what kind of study it is. So when I look at risk versus benefit with immunizations, and really this is something that we do in every aspect of our life. I mean, whenever you make a decision, you look at the risk and the benefit. You don't think about it in those terms, but that's what's going on in your mind. And so for immunizations, for me, having been a pediatrician for the last 20 years, I really think that by far and away, the evidence is out there that the benefit of immunizations far outweighs any risk. Now, does that mean is the risk absolutely 0%? No. But I do think that when you look at the benefit, it just far outweighs any risk that's out there.
Let's talk about some of the older kids. I mean, we've kind of put this in the context early on of kids just getting ready for school, but you know, but we've also got a lot of kids that are going into middle school, into high school. A good number of them are probably going to be participating in sports, and if they are, they're probably coming off of a summer where they've played their sport or sports, quite a bit. So how does a doctor assess fitness for participation on a sports team at the middle school or high school level? What are you going to be looking for? What should a parent be concerned about?
Sure. Well, first, we'd want to know about the family history. So if there's a family history of children or teenagers or even young adults who have heart problems, you definitely want to let your doctor know that there were heart problems present, and if you know any details about those problems, that would be helpful as well. Not just heart problems, also any sudden unexplained deaths in children, teenagers, or young adults, so that could be an indication that there was something underlying with the heart, even though you may not know exactly what that was. So that's going to raise up a red flag that we may need to look into things a little bit more closely.
Things that have happened in the family history, yeah.
Right, exactly. And then things that have happened in that particular child. So here we're talking about symptoms. If there's any exercise-related chest pain, shortness of breath, if they have lightheadedness or feel like they're going to pass out, or maybe they have passed out when they're exercising, those are all going to be things that you want to definitely bring to your doctor's attention and, again, would make us want to look into things a little more closely. And then, of course, physical exam. So we're going to be listening for heart murmurs and clicks, just really any abnormality with the heart sounds and blood pressure, heart rate. So a good physical exam is going to be important, too.
And I know I've seen a number of articles lately on doctors seeing a lot more joint injuries, knee injuries, rotator cuff injuries in students who are involved in athletics, and I mean that's something you're undoubtedly keeping an eye on as well.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the problem there is that kids before their sports season tend to be sitting inside watching screens, playing video games, and then when the sports season starts, they're all about getting into a regimen where they're really active and using their muscles and stressing out their joints. And when those muscles and joints aren't used to being used that way, it's really easy to have overuse injuries. So I think just staying active year-round is really important. And then more and more, we have sports medicine specialists with athletic trainers. And here at Nationwide Children's, we've got a great program for that, where kids can see a sports medicine doc and an athletic trainer even during the off season, just so they can be doing a conditioning and stretching exercises, and that'll really help prevent injury during the actual season.
And let me remind our listeners, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And if you've got a call or a comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And it's interesting, you talk about, kids sitting home playing the video games or whatnot, and then all of a sudden going headlong into full-blown athletic activity. Should we be making sure that the doctor that we visit with our children also assesses those other aspects like media exposure, mental health, depression, discussion of nutrition, exercise, even things like bullying and peer pressure, that sort of thing? Is that something that we should be bringing up?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's where having the parent come up with that list, because you could add to the list that you just went through, and we could spend an hour with a family talking about all of these different things. So I think just being able to prioritize which ones, are really affecting a particular family. But absolutely, we want to cover all of those things. So diet and exercise are important. How much screen time, how much family time is there? And more and more, we really see kids that are stressed out. They're involved in so many activities. They may or may not have a good support network of friends and family, and this leads to anxiety and depression issues. And sometimes it does take the pediatrician or the family practice doc to sit down with the families and kind of tease through those and help people see what problems they may not be seeing.
So how do you deal with that? It sounds like in certainly having been involved in a degree of coaching myself, you see this very intense parents and pushing the kids and all like that. But But how do you, what do you say to the parent and the kid when they're coming in for that visit, to say, you know, hey, you need to really start to kind of seek a little bit of balance out of all of this and maybe just, you know, give your child some rest time?
Yeah, I think a good place to start is just to talk about what is the daily schedule look like. If you're finding that day in and day out kids' time is scheduled, then that may be an issue. All of us really need time just to rest our brains and to spend some time on ourselves. And when every hour of the day is scheduled, it really doesn't leave time to do that. So I think just starting with sort of a log of what does a typical day look like, and then the discussion can go from there.
I mean, that's where you're going to find out whether or not, you know, you need to create some time for the kid to decompress a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
We've seen a disturbing rise in recent years in the teenage suicide rate. Is what's the pediatrician's role in helping to look for that and screen that, and maybe see something that maybe the parent isn't seeing, but you see on that visit that, you know, hey, there's something different about this kid?
You know, kids do an incredible job when they need to put on that mask and be able to hide what's really going on inside. So I'll be honest, during a 15-minute well checkup, you may not be able to catch that. And you really need the parents to have that sense of if there is something going on. Certainly we can ask questions, you know, how much time do they spend alone? You know, do they sleep too much, or are they not sleeping enough? Is there a change in their appetite? Is there a change in their weight, either gain or loss? I mean, anytime that there's something out of the ordinary that's a change in behavior and sleep and eating and even in weight, it could be that there's something underlying that's going on there. And so you do start to ask probing questions. And I find that kids respond the best when you just ask them. Instead of trying to beat around the bush, you just ask them, hey, what's going on? What are the stresses in your life right now? And sometimes they feel comfortable talking about that in front of their parents. Sometimes they, especially if you already have a relationship with them, they may open up a little bit if you have the parents step out and just talk with them one-on-one and just, you know, let them know this is a secure environment where they can talk frankly about these things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I mean, is it even a wise idea for a parent to maybe if they're not really getting a lot of response out of their child, maybe even talk to their friends? I mean, or the parents of their friends?
Yeah, I think that's a fine idea, although I would be real honest with my kid that you're going to do that. So you don't want to look like you're going behind their back and getting information that they're not willing to give you, because then you're not really being a partner in this. But I think it's fine to say, you know, I care about you, I love you, I want to know what's going on in the background of your life, and if you're not willing to share that with me, then I want to ask your friends and I want to ask their parents what's going on. But I think I would encourage parents, obviously we want to have the role of raising our kids, being the right disciplinarian, but at the same time, we do need to have a relationship with our kids. And I think just starting out at a young age and really spending time with them, playing games, doing family stuff together, that really builds the relationship capital to be able to ask those probing questions when life gets a little more complex.
Let's get into the area of the talk. What role do you see pediatricians, what should pediatricians be asking teens about sexual activity and birth control? And it's interesting, we're also seeing a trend towards younger and younger. You normally associate the talk with the beginning of the teen years, but now we're seeing, you know, and hearing from public health officials and other people that, you know, maybe this talk needs to happen earlier.
You know, I'm probably a little more conservative than other doctors that you may talk to. I'm all for families really deciding together what is the most important thing in their family. And I think that parents really coming alongside their kids and should really be the parent who is providing that information for them. The problem is that in a lot of families, parents don't feel equipped to do that, or they're just not interested in doing that. And then I think that's where schools and pediatricians and family practice doctors really have to sort of play a surrogate parent role because the parents aren't stepping up and doing it. Just asking kids if they have any questions about those things, you know, when we see them, and asking the parents if there's any way, you know, if they've talked about those issues, and is there any way that we can support them in the, you know, what they're doing for their family.
Referring back to this panel that you were a part of, you talked recently about the redesign of the pediatric well visit model in the state of California. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, first let me make clear, I wasn't a part of any panel. I just had reported on it on PediaCast. But this was research that came out of UCLA and Mattel Children's Hospital. Dr. Termaine Coker is the guy that's heading it up. And basically his thought is there's just too much to pack into a 15-minute office visit. And so they're really looking at ways that they can redesign the well checkup to make it more beneficial for parents. I mean, for one, extending it beyond 15 minutes, but then it is more difficult for the doctor to sort of have flow and be able to see the patients during the day if you go much beyond that. So the idea was to incorporate parent coaches into the practice, so kind of a physician extender that could help guide moms and dads through concerns and current recommendations and really free the doctor up to spend more time on the physical exam and then critical concerns and recommendations. So one idea was incorporating this parent coach. They've actually divided some practices into two groups of practices, one where the parent coach works one-on-one with parents when they come in for that well checkup, and then another group where a parent coach meets with several parents in a support group style encounter where the parents are helping each other. And so just seeing which one of those things may be more effective. And then also implementing new technologies such as websites, mobile apps, podcasts, just ways to get information into parents' hands in sort of a non-traditional way that utilizes new technologies. So this is a study that's ongoing. They don't really have any results to support what's going to work best, but just the idea that people are thinking, you know, maybe the 15-minute encounter with just the pediatrician or the family doc in the room isn't the most efficient way to get out all the information that we'd like to pass on.
Well, Dr. Mike Patrick, thanks for joining us. This has been very, very, very informative. Certainly, I hope my oldest daughter is listening because she's getting ready to take our granddaughter to in for a checkup soon. So,
sure.
Anyways, but again, thanks for joining us. It's really been great. Dr. Mike Patrick is a pediatrician and the host of PediaCast at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Coming up, we're going to be talking about how to prevent muscle loss as we age. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Stu Nicholson, filling in for Ann Fisher this week. Betty Friedan once said, quote, "Aging is not lost youth, but a new stage of opportunity and strength," end quote. We're focusing on that strength today because as our population ages, nearly 50% of them will be weakened in some way by a loss of muscle mass, a condition called sarcopenia. It's been linked to diabetes, risk of falling, loss of independence, and cost the nation surprising almost $20 billion a year. Joining us now to discuss the latest research on preventing muscle loss as we age is Professor of Public Health at the University of Maryland and Science Advisor to the Aging in Motion Coalition, Dr. Jack Guralnick. Dr. Guralnick, welcome aboard the show today.
Thanks very much.
Good to have you here. And also with us is fitness instructor and founder of Delay the Disease, David Zid. David, I understand you've been here before, so welcome back.
Thank you very much, too.
Good to have you here in the studio and have a human face across the table from me. So
good to be here.
Anyway, but Dr. Guralnick, let me go to you first. Explain to us, I guess, in as Cliff Notes version as possible, I guess, what is sarcopenia?
Well, sarcopenia is a condition that, to a degree, affects all people as they age. It's a loss of muscle. The term comes from the Greek words sarx, which is flesh, and penia, which is poverty or loss of something. So it describes a loss of muscle. We see this kind of universally, but some people lose muscle faster than others as they age, and some people lose muscle to the extent that the associated loss of strength actually ends up having an effect on their ability to function and can then down the road lead to actual disability, loss of ability to be independent.
Is it a genetic thing, or is it just kind of like, you know, something that crosses the DNA barriers?
Well, we don't know. There may be genetics involved. We know that everybody does lose muscle to a degree as they age, and it's related to a number of different factors. We're still learning a lot about it. It's a condition that really has only been recognized for the last couple of decades, and a lot of research is going changes that play a role. Some people have inflammation that comes from chronic diseases that plays a role, and to a large extent, how physically active we are also plays a role in the development of sarcopenia.
And that kind of leads me to the next question. What are some of the telltale signs, if you will, something that you know that a person might notice that is changing or different than what it was for them, you know, a few months or a few years ago? What sort of things should an individual be looking at and that might raise the red flag in their mind and say, maybe it's time to go to the doctor?
Yeah, well, it's something that develops slowly, so it can be difficult to notice. But the thing that people mostly notice is that they're losing strength, that it's harder to go up steps. It's harder to make that big step, say, into the back of a van. Walking is not as easy as it used to be. This is something that family members sometimes notice, even when the person themselves don't notice it. But as I say, it develops slowly, so it's a little bit hard to recognize. Mostly we don't actually notice the loss of muscle. We have a large amount of muscle in our lower extremities, and it's hard to notice a small loss. But you do notice this loss of strength in the daily activities that you do.
Is the muscle then replaced by fat, or is it just everything go away?
Well, both. Some of it is loss of muscle, and some of it is replaced by fat.
And David Zitt, let me turn it to you here too, because you work a lot with older adults. Do you notice a lack of strength in that demographic?
Absolutely, we do. And the signs that we see are people say, you know, we ask them, have you been to the floor? And they say, I haven't been to the floor in years. And the reason they don't go to the floor anymore is because they can't get back up. And that's typically a strength issue. Mm-hmm. All the things that Dr. Jack said is true, you know, up, down flights of stairs. This is such a slow thing that you just don't realize it's happening until it's a little bit too late.
Bending and kneeling and things like that, you know. I suppose that goes to that what you said about, you know, have you been to the floor?
We work with a lot of people that have functional needs, and what I mean by that, Stu, is they have lost daily functions. So they can't get into the car as well as they used to. They can't get out of the car as well as they used to. Things that we take for granted are now tough for them.
And I say this because of the concern over obesity is a national problem and you know, being overweight, and I plead guilty on that count, you know, myself. But you know, are you seeing this starting to show up in younger and younger people, not necessarily the stereotypical, you know, person over the age of 65 or something like that? And let me put that to both of you as a question. David, why don't you tell me what you're seeing?
Well, you know, we typically see people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and we've even had some people in their 90s. So we just tend not to see the younger client. So it'd be hard to answer that question.
Mm-hmm. Doctor, what about you? I mean, is this something that you see showing up in you know, not necessarily young people, but younger than what people might expect?
Yeah, I don't think there's any real evidence that it's happening at younger ages, but as you brought up, we certainly are having an obesity epidemic, and you need your muscles to move your body, and a heavier body is harder to move. So a lot of the issues with sarcopenia are the relationship of how much muscle you have in relation to how much weight you have to move. And so as people get heavier, the same amount of muscle is not going to do the job for them, especially as they start to lose that muscle. Mm-hmm. So the effects of sarcopenia are clearly greater in people who have a higher body weight.
Before we get into the you know what people what older people need to be doing, let me keep this on the thread, if you will, of young people. You know, a lot is put into, you know, preventative or medicine or being proactive. What are the sort of things that younger people, you know, their, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s should be doing just to anticipate that, you know, at some point I'm going to reach the big 5-0 or the big 6-0 and this is going to have an impact. But what should they be doing? What should they be doing now? Maybe, you know, some of it might be great insight into the obvious, but let's talk about that anyway.
Let me start by telling you about an analysis we did of data where we had grip strength, which is a good measure of strength kind of overall in people. We had it in middle-aged people and were able to follow them for 25 years until they became older and found that even in middle-aged healthy people, those who were in the lowest third of strength ended up having substantially more problems when they aged, in terms of both reporting problems and also objective tests like the ability to rise from a chair. It shows that this is really a lifelong phenomenon, that what you're doing when you're young and in middle age will have a strong impact on how well you do, how much reserve you have, so to speak, when you reach older ages.
I've also heard that there's somewhat of a link that's been explored between sarcopenia and diabetes and insulin resistance. What are you seeing on that?
Yeah, there are effects of diabetes and other chronic conditions on muscle that cause muscle loss at a greater rate than in healthy people. So we do see more sarcopenia. We also many diabetics are overweight, and therefore they have more problems with their sarcopenia in terms of functional abilities.
David, let me turn back to you. Take me through how you work with your clients, you know, specific to this issue of combating the muscle loss and maybe building, you know, getting some of it back.
Well, you saw me chomping at the bit over here, didn't you?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Because we see people after they have lost muscle for the most part. So, you know, here's what we do, and I think it works very, very well. We've been teaching this type of regimen for more than 13 years now. What we do is a 12-week strength cycle. And really to break that down in a very short period of time, because I know we're limited here, is the first half of this cycle, we concentrate on your heart, your core muscles, and your joint strength and your integrity. So we think those three things can help set a foundation for bigger strength gains in the second half of this 12-week cycle. So we work on your core, your cardio, and your joint strength the first 6 weeks, and this is a very rough idea of what we're doing. And the second 6 weeks, we really try to increase strength training, and I'm talking about serious strength training. And, you know, the book on strength training is what we call it, is if you want to get stronger, you have to come to failure or fatigue by the end of your set, and that set has to be between 5 and 25 repetitions for a muscle group. Doesn't matter what you're doing, but you have to come to fatigue or failure. Some people don't like that word failure, but failure is a very good thing when it comes to a muscle cell breaking apart and healing and building a stronger muscle. So if you don't like failure, we say fatigue, where you can't do another good repetition. Mm-hmm. And we know that strength comes between 5 and 25 reps, okay? Big range. It's a huge range. We also know that if you do that once a week, you can maintain your strength for that week. So one set, and we call it the big three. You do a pushing move, you do a pulling move for your upper body, and then you do some type of leg move. Mm-hmm. And if you do one set to failure or fatigue in a week, you basically maintain your strength. Now, that's pretty good news, because if you do three sets of something, that's all we're talking about, it takes you less than 10 minutes. This is not a huge time commitment. Now, let's take it one step further. If you do two sets of the same exercises, you just build some strength. Mm-hmm. So we see a really successful program, and we've been doing this for so long. We've taught hundreds and maybe even thousands of people how to do this. And we see strength gains in people in their 80s and even in their 90s which is just fascinating. You know, you start thinking about it, you go, the human body is such a great thing for us, and it adapts to whatever you do to it. And adapting to strength training works really well. And I think, this is how I feel, is the people that even in their 80s and 90s, they see almost the same strength gains as someone in their early 50s, which is just fascinating. Because we always thought, you know, the older you got, you just couldn't gain as much strength. But I don't think that's true. And we see people get stronger. And really, when we say stronger, we say functionally strength, you know, because the people that we work with, they want to get out of the car easier. They want to get off the chair easier. They want to have their daily activities mm-hmm. that they're doing become easier for them. So, but really, and you can go online and Google strength training and mm-hmm. cycles and periodization. I just think, you know, if you're going to get into this, you need to have periods of your 12 weeks or your of your gym life, let's just call it. It has to be light, and sometimes it has to be heavy. Mm-hmm. You have to push yourself. And we do that by just getting you ready to push yourself. We get you in shape to do the workout, so to speak. Does that make sense?
It makes absolute sense. Mm-hmm. Let me again remind our listeners, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you want to call in, our number is 614-292-8513, or you can email us your question or comment at allsides@wosu.org. We've got a caller on the line, Bob from Columbus. What's your question here?
I'm just curious about how, thanks for taking my call also.
Sure.
But I'm really curious about as you look at older people, the skin thins out, and it just seems there isn't any much mass. I mean, you see how babies and children, they're all puffy. The skin is, there's no wrinkles or anything like that. What is it as you grow older that we lose? Is it muscle mass? Is it some of the fat cells inside the body? Is there a way to halt that or arrest that by what we eat and how we can help that? Stay young forever.
Dr. Gralnick, why don't you take that?
Yeah.
It might be something that we've covered before, but go ahead.
Well, it's really all of the above. Certainly, you do lose muscle mass, and some people also lose fat, and it's common after the age of, say, 75 or 80 that people do lose weight. You also have the effect of gravity, which you can't get around, and skin does tend to get looser. The elastic component of skin stretches more with aging, and you put all those together, and you just don't have the same features that you have in a young person. And some of that is remedial by doing the kind of exercises that we've been hearing about here. Some of it is just part of normal aging.
One of the things that comes to mind, you have a lot of older Americans that maybe they're either living alone or they're living in senior centers. You know, again, I can refer to my mom as being one of those. You know, what are the sort of things that they can do on their own? What are the sort of things that they should be doing on their own safely and comfortably? To try and combat this, just, you know, if they can't, oh my gosh, I can't afford to have a trainer, that sort of thing.
You know, that's a great question. What I really feel strongly about is you have to ask the question, why do you want to do this? Why do you want to get strong? And, you know, it comes from within because, you know, as a trainer, we look to try to get people healthier and we're always miffed by why they don't want to. But I think we have to ask the question, why? Do you want to go to Florida, a place that you haven't been for a couple of years because you haven't been strong enough? Do you want to walk your grandkid down the aisle someday? You know, these are things that you have to ask, and you have to say, you have to write them down on paper. So, you know, our listeners out there, please, please, please write something down on paper that's specific and why you're going to get stronger. Now, I think the easiest way to do this is to link something to a habit that you already have. So did we brush our teeth this morning? Mm-hmm. That's a yes. I know you did. Mm-hmm. And if you can link something to brushing your teeth, it's going to happen every single day. So, you know, I think habits drive us as humans. We're habit-driven creatures. And if you can start linking something to a habit, so you watch the morning news and you get the weather report, you're going to do 10 push-ups every morning. You know, that's how you do it. Mm-hmm. You get out of your chair after breakfast and you do 10 sit to stands. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you start linking it to habits that you have. And I think that's a very powerful, powerful tool for us.
David Zitt is a fitness instructor and founder of Delay the Disease. David, thanks for joining us this morning on Wellness Wednesday. And Dr. Jack Guralnick is a professor of public health at the University of Maryland and science advisor to the Aging in Motion Coalition. Doctor, thank you as well for joining us this morning. And thanks to all of you out there for listening in this morning. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.